Hey gang, are you new to this podcast? Have you subscribed on Spotify, Stitcher, or Apple Podcasts and realized that you can only access the 20 most recent shows on these platforms? Do you, my friend, want to binge on How Did I Get Here? Well, check out our archives that are available on the Podbean app. If you follow us on the Podbean app, we have every single show ever released on that platform. You'll also get all of your favorite shows like Fresh Air, WTF with Marc Maron, ID10T, The Michelle Obama Podcast. All podcasts available there, and you can also access over 1,000 How Did I Get Here episodes. So, download the Podbean app from your app store and start listening today. Let's get down.
You gotta open the vault.
Open my vault?
Open your vault.
Once I open the vault, it ceases to be a vault.
You have no choice.
Hey, the vault.
Hello, I'm Johnny. I'm your host, and welcome to another episode of How Did I Get Here from the Vault, where we reach back into our vault of over 1,000 episodes, pull one out, shine it up, and re-release it for you. And now this is getting special because today is Sunday, August 1st, and August 2021 is our 10th anniversary month. Our very first episode came out on August 10th, 2011. So we've been doing this for 10 years, got a ton of shows in the vault. We're very excited to be celebrating this decade of How Did I Get Here with you. And today is a very special episode. Episode 63, featuring Kurt Newman from Bodine's. It originally dropped on April 20th, 2012. That's right on 420, baby. They were about to release their album, American Made, which came out in the summer of 2012. But Kurt and I had an amazing conversation. Now, this is a very special episode for me, and was a very special episode for me when we did it, because I am a Bodine's fan from their very first album, Love and Hope and Sex and Dreams, which came out in 1986. I got that record, I played guitar, and I sang, and I learned how to play and harmonize along with Kurt Newman. I was doing the Sam Yanis part. They used to have a guy named Sam. He was a singer guy. He's gone now. Anyway, after I did this podcast, I became really good friends with Kurt, became friends with his family, became friends with his daughter, Tessa, his wife, everybody. In fact, I just had dinner with Barbara and Tessa a few months ago. Anyway, Kurt and I became friends, and I actually ended up getting to go out and play with Bodine's. I did. I played with them in Houston at the Heights Theater, and I got to open for them that night. I played with them here at the Townsend. I got to go out to Las Vegas and do a show with them and play along with the amazing Kenny Aronoff. So I want to thank Kurt for all the brilliant opportunities that he gave me after we sat down and had this really personal conversation. So as we celebrate a decade of How Did I Get Here, here is episode 63 with Kurt Newman from Bodine's, from all the way back April 20th, 2012. Let's get down.
Feel like stars in the sky, all alone for a long, long time, and there in the air, like a flame, just waving up round to the sound. Don't you wanna come down to the ground? It's time we stop fooling around. And I don't wanna dwell anymore. Just settle the score, run away. Another day is passing me by, you know.
Rockstar. Rockstar.
What's that?
Got your rock star drink going.
Yeah. Well, I got to keep up somehow.
Good job.
Kurt Newman from Bodine's is in my apartment right now, and we're going to talk about this. You have a new album that you just finished making. It's called American Made.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about it.
It's a brand new record. Some new people playing on it, obviously. A couple people who you used to be in the band aren't in the band, but so that's really the biggest change. But musically, it's just, I would say the only difference is it's a little more based on edging towards folk Americana than in the past, I think, as a band, we were nudged along a little bit more towards rock and pop sides of music, where this record has a little bit more of an Americana sound. And I had written some songs that I was trying to write kind of folk songs, but not necessarily traditional folk, but folk in my mind.
What is that? What would you liken that to?
I'm not sure. You know, I like, you know, Johnny Cash early stuff and things like that, but it's a little more driving than that, but it's with that kind of mentality to it, you know. I mean, that's the way it feels in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So what would inspire that? Because I was reading the your newest bio that's on your website that basically deals with this record and how it starts off with you've always thought of the Bodines as a truly American band, but not really like Americana is something that you've...
Yeah, I fought for a long time. Well, I think it was just the times we were in and being on major labels and stuff. There's lots of subtle pressures from people to get on the radio and get your music big on the radio and stuff. So I think you are trying to find a way that you write your music and still have it somehow translate to the radio, whereas nowadays I think that's... I don't have to think like that anymore. So I've come kind of full circle to a place where I feel like you don't fight the phrase roots rock and Americana anymore. It's just who you are. I think I just had a bad definition of it in my mind early on.
Sure.
Thinking that it was some kind of hick music, because we came from a small town, right. And you're always trying to feel like you compete somehow against these major stars that you grew up with that you're being played on the radio with.
Right.
And so I think for a long time I thought of roots rock was kind of a bad word, and it was limiting. I didn't want to be limited by just one category.
Right.
So I think I fought it for a long time to a place now where I think, you know what, to me roots rock really is an incorporation of folk and blues and country and rock and roll kind of all merged together. It's just a real American sound, you know, as opposed to, you know, other cultures and their music. And so I feel more like embracing it. And I think on this record, we just kind of, that's what I was shooting for, is just to let that all happen, let it all come out.
Yeah. So you're from Wisconsin, Waukesha?
Yeah. Well, I was born in Milwaukee, which is a big city, you know, so for the first 8 years of my life, I really had exposure to a lot of living in a big city and crime and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was reading that.
And then when I was 8, we moved out to the country, which was like moving to Mars. It was the strangest thing in the world for me.
And but the impetus was there was a murder of a girl that lived next door to you. And was she young? Was she a friend of yours? And
no, didn't know anything about the person, and no one ever talked about it to me to explain who it was or anything about it. It turns out it was a 9-year-old girl named Donna Willing. And we just came home from dinner one night into our back alley, and it was just lined full of police cars, and they'd found this girl's body. And all my life I'd been walking around telling people this story, like you wouldn't believe what happened when I was a kid. They found this girl's, because it kind of described the neighborhood I was in. I had seen lots of hit and run accidents as a kid. I'd seen people getting stabbed, and my dad worked as a manager of a JCPenney store way down on 35th and North in Milwaukee, which was a lot of crime and stuff. And I would go down there to his store after school sometimes and work with him and stuff in the basement. And so all this was just to kind of represent this area I came from, and what a culture shock it was to go from that out to the woods and the country and wide open cornfields and stuff like that. And so
what was that like? Were you happy? Because I mean, you were 8, so it's like you could run around.
Oh, I was
and
really happy,
be free.
Yeah.
And
I tell people the other story. The first day I was really there in the woods, I was just sitting there listening to the wind blow through the trees, one of my favorite sounds in the world. And it was so peaceful, there wasn't a noise. All of a sudden I hear these leaves crinkling like behind me, and I turn around and look about 10 feet behind me, and there's a horse standing there. You know, just in the woods, a horse is standing there looking at me. And I'd never seen anything like that. I'd never been around anything like that.
Right.
You know, you see pigeons in the city and that's about it.
Yeah.
And it just blew my mind. And it was literally like being on a different planet. And I did love it. The wide open space, the cornfields, the freedom. It was just a wonderful event. And there's a song on the record called Jay Leno that kind of talks about how this girl's death moved my family out to this place and to this freedom I found in this glorious place. And that her death was really, I had never really put it together in my mind, but her death was really the thing that got us out there, you know, that moved me out there to, I don't know what would have happened if I were living in the city in that kind of violent culture, you know.
It's amazing. It's amazing that something can, such a horrible event can transform someone else's life in such a positive way.
Yeah, I was lucky.
How long did you live out there? Until you,
I went to middle school and high school out there, and that's where I met Sam. Finally, was at high school.
And were you already playing then? Like, how did you get introduced to music? Was your family into music or?
Nobody, no one in my immediate or it's just outside silence. Family. Yeah, there was no music anywhere. I don't know, but I was born with just music kind of swimming in my head. It seemed like, and so when I was in sixth grade, my ma said we should learn an instrument or something. So I picked drums and I started taking drum lessons because it got you out of class. You got to go out get a half an hour drum lesson in school. And so to me, that was great. And I just kept doing that through school. I kept taking music courses because it got you out of science classes and stuff. And it was a great place to go. There was always a music room in the school where you could go at any time and you could just get out of the chaos of the school. And so it was a refuge for me, you know?
Yeah.
So I would go and I just stayed in music courses all through school. And so I would meet musicians and I played drums in lots of rock bands in high school and stuff. And when Sam and I met, we had a study hall together, but I was playing in different rock bands back then. And I tried to get him to be a singer in one of them, but they didn't like his voice at all. So they just passed on it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until after really high school where I started. I had two cassette decks and I would start doing like ping pong multi-track recording by bouncing them back and forth and stuff like that. And
you wouldn't believe how many people have this same, the same conversation. I did the same thing because I was having a hard time executing playing and singing at the same time at an early age. And then I realized that if I took the boombox and just played guitar, like a rhythm guitar, then I could just put that tape in my stereo and put the speakers, you know, and do the solos and sing and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I did that with, you know, then I would put drums and keyboards and guitars all down and I would keep bouncing them back and forth, kind of like the Beatles did on their tracks, but with cassette decks. And so I was, you know, that's how I kind of started learning other instruments and stuff around 15, 16 years old and started dabbling in writing songs and stuff like that.
Yeah. And so, When you started a band with Sam, was that you were still playing drums or you had moved on to guitar kind of then? And
you know, in our earliest music, when we would put demos together, I was kind of playing everything.
Okay. And what year was that?
Early 80s.
Early 80s.
82, 83, somewhere in there.
So then you guys formed Bodines. And it really was, as since high school, and I first heard you guys, I wondered if it was some tribute to Jethro.
That's where I think Sam got the name from. When he said it to me, it was about, I didn't know that character.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was his last name and stuff. So when he said it, I thought of Bo Diddley and James Dean.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was like this cool rock and roll icon thing, and it totally related to this sort of rockabilly stuff we were doing in the early days, you know, and it made a lot of sense to me, and I thought that would make sense to other people once they heard the music, too.
Right. So you did start off doing kind of rockabilly. Were you guys singing together then?
Yeah.
Like that?
I mean, we kind of had to. It was just two guitars and two voices.
Right.
We didn't really have a band at first, and so we had to do as much as we could. Sam never played guitar, and I was never a singer, so we had to kind of develop that as we went on.
Wow. But you ended up really developing it well, so.
Well, it was just a natural thing, you know. That was the beauty of it. I think in life, what happens kind of naturally is the best way to go all the time, instead of trying to force stuff. You know, all our music was, back then and even now, is really simple music, simple melodies, simple singing. I never tried to get too deep in stuff because I just love simplicity. I love the message of simplicity that it brings to everyone. It's just got a universal kind of feeling about it.
Me too. And that's, I've always kind of likened you guys to when I first heard you, and I remember thinking that it reminded me a lot of like a modern Everly Brothers, just the way you guys sang together, you know.
Right.
And actually the simplicity of the songs and, you know, the melodies were always really strong. But it must have been so weird. And you guys, how long did it take before you guys got signed?
Not too long. It all happened pretty fast. You know, we played around. We kind of started a band 83, 84, and then by 85, 86, we were getting offers, you know, to go record. And then when they happened, it was all the labels. I mean, Capitol and Warner's and EMI all wanted us at the same time. And so it got to be a real surreal experience.
Yeah, really, what was quickly. That? I mean, you went from the country, and then what did you move back to Milwaukee?
Well, once we were playing as a band, Guy Hoffman, the drummer, joined the band, and then it was just that three-piece. And that three-piece with no bass player was what really caught on. We took it upon ourselves to go to New York, and we got a writer for Time Magazine saw us and wrote an article. And then Spin wrote an article about us being the best, like, unsigned band and stuff. So once that was out there, then the labels were just like, oh, my God, what are these guys? And so then a friend of ours who was a bass player joined the band right as we were kind of getting signed. But it was, you know, it was very surreal, strange experience.
I can only imagine. And plus, it's interesting, and I'm glad that everyone reacted like they did, because what you guys were doing was so profoundly different than what the landscape was littered with at the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's, you know, being in a small town, that it affords you that luxury of coming up with your own sound. And again, we were limited as musicians and players, kind of what we could do and stuff, and all of that, you know, made the music what it was, which I think made it interesting at the time too.
Right.
It wasn't Bon Jovi and all the bands that were
making
that big, huge power pop sound, and that just wasn't something we could do.
Or those like kooky, like synth drum machine records and stuff.
Yeah, so. Yeah. When I say that, I don't mean to cut down anything.
No,
because
not at all.
I think it was all great music. It's just we couldn't do stuff like that.
Yeah,
you know.
So tell me about, you guys got signed, was there like a bidding war and stuff like that? And
yeah, you know, the first time I ever got on a plane in my life was when the record company flew us to LA and, you know, wined and dined us a bit.
Right.
Of course, the LA police threatened to throw Sam and I in jail that night.
For what?
For just walking down the street. And we weren't doing anything, and they said if we didn't go back to our hotel, they were going to take us downtown and... just for walking the street.
How weird.
Yeah.
Oh, that's odd. Well, so where were you at, like personally? Like, how is that, you know, did it freak you out? Did you get freaked out at that time?
No, I didn't.
No?
I just thought it was, it'd be great to be able to play music, you know.
All the time,
put out a record and just do it. I think we were too busy kind of having fun with it all. You know, we were lucky that we weren't loving the drugs at the time, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's, if we would have been into feeling great all the time like that, it could have probably, I mean, I watched that tear so many people down around me.
Yeah, at exactly that time,
right.
Too.
So I think that
so prevalent.
We just loved the music so much that we didn't let it, we just kind of were riding it, you know, as this is great, this is fun, let's have fun with it.
You know? You guys are you guys more beers and brats guys?
Back then, sure.
So how did you choose T-Bone Burnett to do that record?
We just loved his records. We were big fans of his records, and then he had produced Los Lobos record that we liked as well, and it just seemed like he understood our sound.
Yeah.
Whereas, like I'm saying about all these other big bands and stuff with big time producers, I think our fear was they wouldn't have understood what we were
and
what our limitations were.
Yeah,
might have tried us. So we knew T-Bone wouldn't try to change anything.
Right, and back then there was also like a lot of there was a kind of a culture of a producer getting a band to come in and then replacing all the dudes for the record. You know what I mean? And doing
absolutely.
That kind of thing, which kind of kills what the band got signed for in the first place, you know?
Yeah, and it's tough. You know, it's hard to make a good sounding record sometimes, you know, with a drummer who's not a great, great player, but, you know, it's hard to capture just good personality when you're trying to keep in time. And you can hear it on that record, too, with some of the songs you put on, and they just, like, take off.
Yeah.
I mean, this was before the age of click tracks and stuff, so it was just like 1, 2, 3, go. And I think T-Bone was perfect for that, in that he would encourage you to come in and each day and do the song kind of differently and see what happened with it.
Yeah.
Very moody, and his opinion was like, use that moodiness, you know.
That's really good, man. I think that really comes through.
Yeah.
So then the record came out, and it was just embraced, you know, especially critically. It was like insanely...
It was embraced in the college
charts
and markets and stuff, but we still struggled to get on any commercial radio.
Right.
But it was certainly the hot, critically acclaimed record of the time. Yeah.
Definitely. And you guys were voted the best new American band in Rolling Stone and stuff.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, so what did you do on that? Did you go on tour with other bands that were like college bands, like R.E.M. or something like that? It's the only band I could think of.
No, we didn't. Because we liked putting on at least like 2-hour shows, is we really wanted to go out around the country and show everyone kind of who we were, you know, and so we opted to just go to every, knock on every door sort of in America and play our stuff for whoever showed up. And, you know, at first there weren't a lot of people showing up, but by the end of like a full year of touring, it got really to where we could expect a sold out show everywhere we went, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So I just, that was an amazing feeling.
We didn't get on the second record. We got on the Joshua Tree tour. Our touring agent was always asking us, like, well, you know, who would you tour with? You know, because they knew we didn't want to open.
You too.
And I said that. I said, well, maybe we'd play with you too, because I really liked their energy a lot. And then it wasn't even a few weeks later, they called and said, you want to do some shows on the Joshua Tree tour? And we're like, okay.
Wow, that must have been amazing.
Yeah, it was. It was a great time. Great. Those guys were a great band. They had a great crew. To this day, more people come up to me and say, I saw you on the Joshua Tree tour than anything else, you know.
Right.
So you reach a lot of people, and so we were really grateful to them.
Yeah, yeah. And they liked you guys then.
They did, yeah. They would be on stage watching us almost every night. It was crazy.
Did you guys ever tour? Was Wire Train on that tour with you guys ever? Or were they on different parts of it or something? Do you remember that band? Or?
I know the name, but they weren't on with us. We played with us and the Pretenders and U2 at, like, Oakland Stadium and LA Forum and places like that.
Okay.
Yeah, unreal, you know, 50 to 100,000 people in an audience.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're still 30 yards away from the closest person, which is, you know, that's a whole club length, you know.
Sure. Did you feel cuz even I have this documentary that just came out about U2 about kind of what they did afterwards with Octoon Baby, and during that time they felt like they were engulfed by these stadiums. They had gone from playing, you know, smaller places to playing these huge places where they didn't feel like they had enough of themselves to put out there. Were you intimidated by the size of the venues you were playing at all?
I wasn't intimidated. It was so kooky, you know, that we were just laughing about it, you know?
Yeah.
It was just like...
We didn't feel like you had to jump around and do these huge, gigantic movements so that the guy...
You try. Yeah. I mean, you certainly try to be more active on a big stage. And at one point, I had gone out on the side of the stage where the PA is just to try and hear my guitar once while I was playing. And it felt like, you know, a nuclear explosion was behind me because, you know, you're like 2 feet from these cabinets that are filling a stadium. It was unbelievable. It was just funny. Like, when I keep saying surreal, it's the only way to explain it. It wasn't intimidating at all. It was just goofy, crazy experience, you know.
Yeah.
Just nuts. You know, it was a lot of fun, fun all the time. We were lucky that way that... You know, because it didn't seem real at all, we could just have fun with it.
So with the label, after your first record, you went in to do your next record. The second one was Outside Looking In, right?
Yeah.
And so, which is probably an apt title for going through some kind of machine and you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it felt like. I mean, it still felt like, even though we had a lot of popularity in some camps, that we weren't the pop sensation band of the moment. Right. So We were okay. always kind of on the outside that way.
Yeah. Well, it's still kind of cool to be like that.
It is, yeah. It, you know, it's
you get to
it's
keep just, your head a little more.
What's hard is, the hardest part is on a major label is that they want you to be the big
right.
scoring band. And Warner's was our choice, hands down, because of any major label, they were going to understand you the best, you know. They were going to give you the most leeway to be who you were. But there was always still, you know,
pressure.
Our A&R lady was great, but she must have felt a lot of pressure from other people about, yeah. you know, these guys need to, something has to happen, you know, but she was in there fighting for us. And so we had good advocates there. You know?
It was almost like you were their Wilco of that time, you know.
Well, Wilco was there with us.
Yeah.
They were on Reprise the same time we were. And yeah. I think we had kind of blazed a trail for that. You know, for bands like Wilco to come through and play that card, sort of, you know,
yeah.
of like, we're like them and you need to understand our music too. It's just, I think that they, I don't know how to put it exactly, but I think somehow they were able to kind of keep pushing forward at times where Bodine's had internal struggles in the middle years that kind of stopped us from having some of the success that bands like Wilco went on and had.
What were the struggles? Was it tough? I mean, right.
Well, I just think people were pulling in wrong directions. And eventually, you know, where in the young years we were just like, it didn't matter. It's just fun. I think you finally hit points where, you know, you have two writers, two singers. We had a friend who was a manager. He really wasn't a manager at all. And so,
right.
At some point, it just kind of like runs into a wall. And, you know, I think in last year, it's really what happened with Sam and I, too. It's just like you get to this place where you just can't. The communication is just kind of stopped and it's not working anymore. And I was kind of single-handedly doing records since the late 90s for Bodine's because no one else was there to do it, you know.
Right.
And so I would be either doing everything on the record or hiring people to do it with no one around. And I think it just, you hit that point where you're not communicating anymore and you're not doing something positive anymore. And then the wheels kind of fall off. And it's hard and very rare for bands
to stay together.
To keep any kind of that common ground, you know?
Yeah. You start seeing people differently, you know? And they start seeing you differently. And it's like marriage.
Yeah.
Some marriages.
Yeah, I think in 98 when Sam kind of stepped away for his solo record, I think it was at a point where he was ready for a solo career. And I mean, that's my opinion about it, and that he that's kind of what he always wanted. And so, you know, I was cool with that. I just wanted to really kind of know that's where you were going so I could go this direction. I didn't want to be spending... See, you put a lot of hours in on a record when you're the one kind of doing it, and it's hard to have someone else kind of pull it apart and stuff when you've put all these hours into something. But if everybody has the same belief system, like we're all together and united on this, it's easy to dedicate the hours into it. It just gets hard when nobody's there with you anymore. And then it feels like, well... Yeah, I'm here all alone doing this work, and it doesn't make sense. It's not really a band anymore.
Yeah.
So
it's a weird feeling. I've been in that place, too.
Well, it didn't feel weird as much. It felt natural. You know, I totally understand you got two songwriters who want to express themselves. I think that's natural. My feeling about Bodine's and going on with it, though, was just that I had... I wasn't ready to give up Bodine's. You know, I really wanted it. To me, Bodine's always had a personality of its own. It wasn't me or Sam or anyone else. We had a lot of band members come through the band in the 90s and early 2000s, you know.
Yeah.
But it wasn't about any one person. It was really about these fans' attachment to these songs that meant something in their life. And I wasn't ready to stop doing that because I think I had put so many extra hours into it and stuff that it just, maybe it meant, had more of a personal significance for me. I don't know, but. So I just felt like, you know, I'd like to go on and see for at least for another year or two and see what happens with it. And, you know, which is really the point of the American-made record and putting it out and seeing where it goes. I understand it's not exactly the same sound, but I think the same energy and intentions are kind of behind the music.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a Bodine's album, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think it sounds like one.
Yeah. Yeah, so let me get back real quick. Is when you went to go do your second record and you did it with Jerry Harrison, was there some kind of, when you went in at that point, was there some kind of pressure like, hey, we're going to need to get some numbers?
Certainly, yeah, certainly there was.
How did that affect, were you more nervous that time? Were you...
No, I had written Only Love and Dreams, the two songs on the record.
Amazing songs.
Right, like the week I was home from recording the first record. You know, we finished the first record and I got home. I didn't have anywhere to live, so I was in my old bedroom of my parents' house. And those songs just blew out of me. And when the record company heard them, they thought that those were good radio options. So it was just a matter of finding someone who could record them and make them sound like Bodine's and still sound like they should be on the radio.
Yeah. How did you like working with Jerry Harrison?
He was great. You know, he was really nice to us and stuff. I would have, in retrospect, I would have preferred to go back with T-Bone. But at the time, I don't think it was an option. I don't think the label would have let us because they know the record would have sounded like a T-Bone record again. And we were... You know, Only Love comes out sounding like a little bit harder rock song instead of quite like it did on the first record.
Right. You know? It seemed like stylistically and sonically, it seemed a little bit more ready for radio, a little bit more not in its own head. Like the first one was, you can tell people were like encapsulated in this place and nothing was really affecting them.
Right. Yeah.
So...
No, definitely. The second record has more of that on it, you know. There's a little more power to it, a little more grunge and grind to the guitars and stuff like that. And so that was definitely some of the mindset. And Only Love did pretty well. It got on the radio. It got on the rock stations and stuff. So I think, you know, it sold 2.5 times what the first record sold right away. And so I think the record company was pretty happy about it.
Good. It's probably all the touring and stuff you did.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then you guys, that's when you guys got, how did you get together with Robbie Robertson? And was he a fan of the band?
Yeah, he called and said, you know, he was working with lots of different people on that record and said, I want those harmonies on my record. And
how fucking cool. I mean, like what?
Well,
what
it was the same thing. I mean,
yeah, just blow your mind. Like, I mean, did you grow up listening to the band?
I did, but, you know, I wasn't fanatical about them, but I certainly knew them. I knew their music, and I knew Robbie. I knew what, you know, I'd seen The Last Waltz, you know, everybody did. And so it was like, sure, you know, I mean, why not? And, and from the moment, you know, we walked in and started singing, you know, he was just like, oh, I love it. It's perfect. And so it was very easy, very natural. And a great That's guy awesome. To be around. He's a great storyteller. And
I bet.
When you're around him, there's always great stories in women somehow. he's a wonderful guy to hang
How
around.
How cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know. So then you guys went into your third album, and you went in with Jim Scott. Was he the engineer on that record? Or
engineer, producer, yeah.
No, I mean on the Robbie Robertson
Yes,
record.
That's okay. What we met.
Because it was a Lenoir record, right?
Right.
Okay. I feel like such a dork right now. So that was a Lenoir record. Well, the producer. Well, I think the second engineer was. So that album was Home. Yeah. And is that was the first record that Ramos was on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had toured with us for the tour before that record. But he was on that record, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great guy. So he's still with you?
Yes, he is.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm happy. You know, he and I have maintained a pretty close relationship. And from the very get-go, his sense of melody and playing worked really well with me, you know, with what I was doing, my songwriting. Everything he played fell right into place for me. I was really happy.
Yeah. His sense of humor gets me, too.
He has a lot of the same... you know, philosophies, ideology that I do and stuff, so we're easy to be around.
Right. Well, I saw you guys on that tour because of him. I knew him before that. I was living in Houston at the time, and it was like 2 days, I think, I'm pretty sure, it was like 2 days after my 21st birthday, and you guys played like two nights or something at Rockefeller's in Houston. Yeah. And I went to both of those shows. They were fucking amazing. Like, yeah. Seriously, I was like, I was so sold. And I remember going backstage and I was so like completely starstruck by you and Sam. Like, I was just like, I cannot believe these dudes are here. But then I also became friends with Rafael during that time too.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. He's in LA now, right? You keep in touch with him?
No, he's living, I think, in a place called Marshall, Texas or something like that.
Really?
Yeah, because he just moved there.
Okay.
I just saw him recently. He came to a couple shows and I've talked to him, and we've been searching for drummers for a while too, and he was one of the guys I was talking to, but he's pretty busy with Leonard Cohen stuff too. So,
oh, right.
So that's, he really, right, he can't necessarily Cohen. Commit. So, but yeah, we keep hoping he can come back and play with us sometime.
Right. And so then after, how was that experience, like doing that tour and everything? Was it, things were staying level? You guys doing a little bit better? Or was there any kind of like...
I think it was, home was not quite as what people wanted. I think everyone was looking for us to hit it out of the park with home. And we couldn't really find a producer was the problem. We had gone out and tried to work with some different people and it didn't work out and stuff. And
right.
So I think the home record, we hired a remote truck to come to our warehouse, and we just thought we'll just record and we'll see what happens, you know. And at one point the record company actually cut off all the funding and stuff because
I'm sorry, I mean,
they didn't know what we were doing. They didn't hear anything. They had no idea what was going on, and they thought we were just blowing money or something. And so
were the budgets getting bigger with each record?
Well, not for that record. I mean, that's about the cheapest you can do a record.
Yeah.
But they were looking for more. And I think, you know, I think when they heard You Don't Get Much and Good Work, they thought they could do something with that. I think everybody thought You Don't Get Much would do well on the radio.
Yeah.
But the similarities to the U2 sound and stuff were, I think, were too close for
people.
Yeah,
I was just singing that song in my head and I was saying, wow, it really does have a U2. I didn't even put
it
together.
Yeah, it definitely
then.
Does. Well, the thing about it, I had always used delays on my guitars in the early years, but they were always tighter. They were slapping kind of delays that would work in kind of a 16th note fashion with the guitar. When I hit it, it would slap back at me at a 16th. Well, the Edge was using like dotted eighth note delays. And, what, you know, that's the first thing I recognized about him. It's like, this guy uses delays the same way I do. He uses them for rhythm. He's like a rhythm section. And so when I stretched out my delay, you know, I knew exactly what he was doing and how he was doing it. So it seemed, you know, natural, kind of like I was tipping my hat to him and stuff, but certainly wasn't trying to take their sound or anything, you know, but I can certainly see the resemblance.
Yeah.
And it was being on the Joshua Tree with them.
Sure.
I loved their big heroic songs they were doing.
Yeah, it's, you know, you run around or you hang out in the studio while someone's making a record, and you're inevitably something you write after that is going to be informed in some way by it, you know?
Yeah.
So then you guys, you went and worked with David Z from Prince. What was that like?
Weird? I think that was the one record that Sam and I really just kind of checked out on a little bit. You know, we put everything in his hands, David's, and because he had such a great history with pop radio and stuff, we thought, we wrote a great batch of songs. Really, those songs have gone on to be a mainstay for Bodine fans.
When
you think of Good Things and Naked and Paradise and songs like that, there were so many good songs on that record that we just put it in his hands, you know, and he said, well, how about this? And we'd go play it, and he mixed it, and that was it. But most people thought, this doesn't sound anything like Bodine's, you know. I mean, for a lot of people who were longtime fans...
Right.
They were really offended by that record because it just didn't sound roots rock, you know?
What is that like? What did that feel like? Were you like, ow, sorry?
Well, we were caught in the middle, you know? That's what I'm saying, you know? You want a label who's wants to get you on the radio, wants you to have huge records. And at the same time, with the home record, we did things our own way.
Right.
And it, you know, people weren't knocked out. So we thought, let's give it to this big time producer and see what he does. And then he did that, and it wasn't really us either, you know.
Yeah.
Which took us to the next record. But I those records all sold pretty well, you know. I think they did good things. It's the funny thing about that record is we were getting pushed by Bob Cavallo, who came on kind of as a management at the time, and he pushed us to do a rock song, which we wrote for the record, but it was, it just wasn't us at all, you know?
Right.
And they pushed and they made a huge budget video for it and everything, and it never went anywhere.
Did they ever set you up with like Desmond Child or anything like that? Like,
no.
Kurt, we got a great idea for you.
It was like, yeah, it was kind of like that though with Cavallo and stuff, but the funny thing about the
That's
record
big
is...
big Cavallo, right?
Yeah.
Not the older one. Cavallo, yeah. Yeah,
the older one. And but the funny thing was is Good Things went on and became a number five single anyways, which the label was actually upset about because it was getting in the way of the single they wanted to push. And that is the struggle of being on a major label.
Yeah.
Is there's a song taking off on its own and you want to ignore it.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, it was bad.
Yeah, I had the same kind of experience. I was on a subsidiary of Elektra that was owned by Lars Ulrich, but my band didn't really play music that I think he really understood.
Yeah.
And then nobody there liked him, even though he made all their money.
Yeah.
So there's always those weird kind of like things that, that go on like that that are kind of a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Kind of a pain in the ass. They're super pain in the ass.
Yeah.
So then you guys, you did Black and White. You went back with T-Bone.
Yeah.
That was good. Good
that
experience.
Was good. Yeah, it was strange because we had recorded a whole record and the label's opinion then was the record sounds too good and we wanted to sound more roots rock. So I literally myself had to go in and replay the record, you know, play the drums and bass and guitars in a way I knew they wanted to hear it, meaning you had to go in and play it not too good. You couldn't make things sound too punchy and rock or anything. Everything had to sound kind of unproduced and strange a little bit. So I had to go in and do all that.
Was
for
that
record.
Some kind of reaction to what was going on?
Yeah,
what
they
was,
wanted us now to get our critically acclaimed kind of... record back, you know, after I had been pushing for three records for you to get on the radio. So we were now, that record was a total, the strangest record I've ever made probably.
Yeah.
To try and make something to sound more like your first record, you know, to go back and don't sound too good now.
Right.
You know, make it sound unpolished and stuff. And by then we had gotten better at playing and recording. So it took a conscious effort to try and play things in a way that was not too produced and not too good sounding.
Right. And so what that's Closer to Free was on there?
Yeah.
As well.
Right. But that was the one track that we got to keep from the original first session.
Okay, so that's not you playing all the stuff on there.
That well, I'm playing all the guitars and everything. Okay, yeah. But Kenny's Aronoff played drums.
Oh, yeah. How was that working with him?
Well, I love him.
Yeah.
He's great energy, great person.
Yeah. So when you got that song on Party 5, how long was that after that? I never saw that
show.
That
was about 3 or 4 years after the record came out. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it wasn't a single. Closer was never a single off the record. Idaho was the single, and you know, Idaho did great at AAA, went in the top 10, stayed there for a long time.
That must have been interesting for you because at that point there was AAA. When your first record came out, there wasn't.
Yeah, no, we were really a pioneer. There were a few bands around that time that really defined what AAA was going to be.
Yeah.
And we were lucky to be one of those bands.
So kind of like what KGSR was, you know, at one point here.
KGSR was great. They played us since
played the
late 80s.
Yeah, totally.
I don't even recognize them right now, though. It's strange to turn it on and I hear music that I thought was a pop station. And then all of a sudden, you find out it was KGSR, and I'm just like, wow.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Yeah. For some reason, I always end up hearing the Spin Doctors now when I turn it on. It freaks me out. Nothing against the Spin Doctors. It just freaks me out.
Yeah.
And then you did a live album. It's pretty... Just from that, it was that one that you had from like the
compilation. 80s? Yeah. I had always pushed us to record live shows, which back then was no small feat. You know, you had to get a mobile truck.
Yeah, it wasn't like
tape
now. You bring your laptop
in it. Yeah, yeah, and an old Neve console, and they would record you. And we had just kind of stockpiled these tapes from all these shows that we had recorded back then. And I just decided the time was right to go in, and so I went through everything we had, and I found the best of what we had and put it all together, and then I sold the record company on it, and it turned out to this day it's one of our best selling records at all. You know, a double live record,
it's
outsold any of the early records.
And you guys are known for live shows, like at this time, you know, you're like a live staple.
Yeah, Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, you do a lot of do you do festivals?
Yeah,
a lot of, yeah.
Everything. You know, I've never had a year off, and since we started this, I've never had a year or two where I didn't play.
Yeah,
we always have played and played and played.
Good. That's what you got to do.
Well, you know, it's just who we are. I mean, you live. I think because we had a long career, people imagine you must be a rock star millionaire, but we're not. You know, we're like everybody. We live month to month and pay our bills the best we can, just like everybody.
Not me. I'm a rock star millionaire. In case you can't tell by your surroundings. So then you guys went through the 90s. You made more records, and then there was the like late 90s split. Where Sam went and did his... Oh, wait, you did the albums... Oh, that was later on. Sorry, I'm just...
We did one more after Go Slow Down.
Okay.
Did Blend.
Right.
And then Sam did his record, and yeah.
And you did one too, right?
I did, yeah. It was, you know, it was kind of a learning about... Recording had kind of gone to a different place by then. Digital recording had kind of come on the scene, so... My record was a little bit of a delve into that, about what you could do in a bedroom, because I didn't... Sam had taken control of the studio for his record, so he was...
You guys had a studio.
Yeah, in Milwaukee.
In Wisconsin. Yeah.
Yeah, so he had used that, so I had taken upon myself to just buy some digital recorders and go in a back bedroom and see if you could make a record that way, and that's what I did.
How... Are you happy with it? Was it...
I like it a lot.
Did you
yeah,
play
yeah.
everything on it? Did you use loops yeah. or something?
Cause no, that's I played. What you well, play. I did. I played. What did I do with the drums? I used samples. Is what I did, but they weren't loops. I actually programmed like parts. But yeah, it was. I did everything on the record. However, you could do it.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a setup where I could record drums. I think I probably could have now when I think back about it, but I just didn't. But I do. I like the record. But my frustration was I it was a mistake. What I told everyone in Bodine's was that stopping the band right now is a big mistake. You know, this is not a time for solo records. It was really a time to dig in your heels and make the best Bodine record you could. So it was a frustrating time.
After
for me.
Party of Five had kind of taken you guys to a new level.
Yeah. And I think, you know,
kind of get the bases loaded to put a baseball analogy to it.
Yeah, I believe our old manager and Sam kind of had ideas about them stepping off and taking off from there, and I think I was going to be kind of left aside, and when that all didn't work and they wanted to come back to Bodine's, it was just kind of like you have those feelings of just like, is everybody really into this? Is this the right thing?
Did your
to
thing
do?
Just not work out, and this is what you got? Yeah,
that's what it felt like to me from where I was standing, and so it didn't feel as good, you know, and then we went on many years of just nothing happening after that. And until I finally said to Sam and Bob that, you know, if we don't put out a record now, we might as well just stop, you know. And so once again, I took it upon myself to put together a record for us. And again, it was in a small shack outside my house.
Here in Texas?
In Buda.
In Buda, yeah.
And... it came out, Rounder Records picked it up. It was the Resolution record that just kind of got us working again.
Right.
After so many years of not putting anything out.
You feel like you had to rebuild it. Is that around the time, is that like 2004?
Yeah.
Because I remember I wanted to go to the music hall and see you guys in Big Star.
Yeah,
but
right.
You were playing at the same time I was playing somewhere else. That was a bummer.
Yeah, that was, and it did feel like rebuilding, you know, and that was basically what I was saying. Everyone is like, we can try to rebuild this back up and all, but we got to all be in together, you know. We can't have separate agendas about it. It's too hard, you know. As you get older, the industry's less and less interested in really hearing you, and you're not the new young band on the scene, so it's tough, you know. You got to really want to play music to stay in it. You got to love what you're doing.
Yeah.
So that was my only premise to everyone, is we got to all be in this together if it's going to work.
Yeah. Well, I like that. I mean, I'm glad that you've opened this part of a conversation, because it's something that I'm entering. I mean, I'm 43 and I don't want to stop playing music because I'm, you know what I mean? There's something about growing old gracefully
and it's
in
what
this
you
business
do.
And not being worried about who you might have been or keeping up with the very young people. And also there's a matter of keeping yourself interested and open, where you're not jaded and
yeah.
pushing things away just because they're not like it used to be. You know what right. I mean? Do you struggle with that at all as a person?
I think, yeah, you know, I struggle with where the industry's at all the time. If, you know, I've never been a big fan of the music business.
Me neither.
You know, and I think anyone who loves music tends to have that.
Yeah.
That philosophy. They don't like the business and how it's sold. And so I look at it these days and I just shake my head at it too. When everyone was against the majors, you know, in the 80s and 90s that they were stealing, I always liked the major labels. There were pressures, you know, but they did so much for you as a band. I mean, they put so much money into building your career. I always had a lot of respect for that, and I was grateful for it. And this idea of we should make our own records and get all the money ourselves is people have learned now that it's just crazy. You just don't have enough funding to make that happen, you know. And then everyone makes a record, you know. So the market gets saturated with all this music, more music than people can even hear or listen to, and no one has any resources for getting it heard. And so it just kind of like goes nowhere. And I think now the industry is just a big mess. And as a older artist and stuff, or as you get older, you're just kind of lost in that shuffle, that mass of music that's out there.
Yeah.
You gotta want to just play it to play it, I think, because I don't think the industry is going to come around and support it for many, many, many years. And if you want to make a living, you kind of have to find a way to make a living and then a way to play music too, you know, is where I think it's going to get to or is at.
You just made me sad.
Yeah, sorry.
No. That's all right, because I started a talk show that will eventually bring me millions of dollars.
Well, yeah, I think it's the same advice as always. You got to do what you love, and I think the universe conspires to assist you.
Yeah.
If your heart is true in what you're doing, I think things will work out. But it's, like you say, if you get caught up in the negativity or blaming or any of that kind of stuff.
You seem like you don't harbor any kind of resentments like that. Like, you are very clear-headed and very, you have a good sense of who you are and where you stand. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've been extremely fortunate with my music, you know. I was extremely lucky to get all the things I got to do in my life, you know. We were talking about Robbie Robertson. I hung out with Robbie one night where I was in the studio with Robbie and Bob Clearmountain mixing the record, and then went over to Keith Richards' studio and hung out with him for a while, and Steve Jordan and all those guys in the same day. And the day before that, I had been rehearsing with Robbie when Mick Jagger was there in the place with us. And all these things as a kid, you know, are just unbelievable experiences. You never imagine such things and stuff. And that's just, you know, a couple days of the great luck I had. You know, people embraced my music, and who could ask for more than that? So I can't look back and be bitter about if I have to give up playing music someday or something, because I've had great, great luck with it.
What would you do? But you don't really have extensive training in anything else.
No. I tell people that I've worked in car washes, drying off cars before I played music, you know. So
there's always that.
that would be my skills, you know.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I don't know what I would do, but I would love to offer assistance to younger bands and people and try to help them weed their way through this business of music. It's not so much I don't think of being a producer, but I think of being a person who could help guide them through the mess of it all and avoid some of the pitfalls that are waiting out there.
Yeah. Have you ever produced other artists?
Not any big records or anything like that. You know, I've worked with people here and there and tried to, you know, help them along, but I haven't never produced a big record.
Have you ever been asked?
Yeah, I just never found the time. You know, I was always, like I'm saying, I was doing everything with Bodine's,
right.
You know, physically putting a studio together or physically playing everything on a record, it takes a lot of time. So I never had the open time to go and dedicate to someone else's project.
I think that's amazing, though, that you kept your commitment to an idea that you started, as opposed to going and advancing your own personal thing in other ways. I think there's something very beautiful to be said about that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like any business. I mean, I feel it's if you started a business making, if you had a bakery, you know,
yeah,
for all these years and for 30 years, you built up that bakery, and you, every morning you got up and you went to work and you made that stuff and you sold that stuff. You just have a love for that goes beyond anything. And just because if you started it with someone else and they decided they wanted to spin off their own bakery, it wouldn't break off your love for what you started and worked on for 30 years. That's the way I feel about right. it, you know. It's the same as any business that you've built up for all these years and you've put your heart and soul into it and you just can't walk away from it. That's where we are with this record now, you know, with me and Ramos and the other guys who are going to be, you know, Warren Hood's going to be out with us and stuff. Come to know around town here. Michael I've known forever, but Warren I've known for about 5 years now, and I've been playing on and off with him when he has time, and I
love him.
I do too. He just brings such a great personality to everything he plays, and
yeah,
and he's does the same on this record, you know.
Yeah.
And then we have some youngsters playing and with us too, and it's just been very liberating.
I saw Jake Owen did some playing. I like him a lot too.
Yeah, and Jake's been playing and touring, really nice guy. And so having another guitar player who can really play guitar in the band, because
you've always been primarily the guitar player. Even though Sam was playing acoustic, you were the guy.
Yeah,
you were the only guy.
Yeah, and I played all the guitars on the records. I mean, even the acoustics and stuff as well. Yeah. It was just what I did, and. But having another player like Jake out there, it's so liberating. And Warren, I have two other instrumentalists that I can, it's the whole process, even though it's been a dark kind of process of Sam leaving the band, has also been extremely liberating to me, as well as I can pursue ideas I've had for many, many years without having this darkness kind of shoot it down or think, oh, that won't work, or that's a bad idea, or even when you do get to do it, there's a negative approach to it and stuff. And to be away from that, it feels like you can breathe again. So, you know, I hope people like the new record. I hope we get allowed the chance to go on and play for a few more years with it at least. But if they don't, that's cool too. I'll get it. But I think the record's got a sound to it that people will like. I hope so.
Well, good. I'm excited to hear it.
Yeah.
So when does it come out?
It comes out June 12th officially.
Okay.
It is going to be... I think, I don't know exactly when this is being aired, but I think next Thursday or Friday, KUT is going to make one of the songs Song of the Day. So it'll be on the radio in the next month.
And then you're going on tour of the United States for basically the summer.
Yes, we are going to get on a bus and do old school knocking on every door kind of touring again.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, I mean, I'm sure, and they're going to be your own shows and...
Yeah, right now we just have all our own shows, whether they're small theaters and clubs and stuff like that, that we're going to. And I don't know about later in this late summer, fall, but for now, that's what we got planned.
Right. Well, I got to tell you that one of my best friends is from Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and actually a theme song for our show is from their band, Sheboygan.
Yeah.
Just so you know, there's a little Wisconsin connection here.
I used to know a girl in Sheboygan.
Sounds like the opening line of a song.
Yeah.
Kurt, is there anything I'm missing here?
No, I think you've covered everything.
Your album American Made comes out in June. Everyone get it. And now, how are you releasing that? Is there a label putting it out?
Well,
or you?
We've over the last like 10 years kind of refined the idea of putting things out on your own label. So we do have our own label, but we're working with Megaforce Records and Red Distribution, which is really the biggest companies you can work with out there. So, it'll be on our own imprint, but
what is that called?
It's called FNA Records.
FNA,
which is Free and Alive.
All right, Free and Alive. Well, you are. Yeah. You are free and alive, and you're living in Buda. You're having a good life. I spoke to your wife the other day on the phone. She said you're not on Facebook because you need to join the real world. But then I told her I think there was a mistake in that.
Yeah,
I think you might actually be in the real world.
Yeah. Right. Actually, just we are living in Dripping Springs now.
Oh, Dripping Springs.
But we did live in Buda, but it's so we're out in Drip, and it's we shot the video for the first song out there as well at a place called Barbershop Bar, and it's a great little thing. It's going to be on TV real soon. So
and can people it's not finished yet or it's not released yet?
It's not released
yet. People
will
be able to see it on your website is bodines.com.
Pretty soon they're going to be able to see it. one of the video stations is picking it up, so
oh, good.
It'll be all over.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And your website is bodines.com, right?
Bodines.com.
Okay. Yep. Then they can find out when you're playing and when you're coming to a town near you.
Yeah, there should be all the info up there. And I don't know what Facebook is, but I guess we got something like
you're
that.
You're there on Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can find, just, I guess Googling is really the best way to do it, is what I find out from my guests who go like, well, just Google me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about it these days. There's it's a strange thing with the internet, because I struggle with it in that there's, it's just kind of based on opinion and perspective now, as opposed to facts or truth on the internet. But that's the new medium. I think that's why I struggle with being on it so much, as compared to other people really like it. But I think it's for those reasons, is that they can have a virtual life. And I'm a big fan of this.
Of real life?
Real life that I got already. So yeah. I struggle with the virtual life.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, you don't, you know, there's, unless you need to be on it, there's no need to. I will say that last night on my way home from my gig, it was like 2:30 in the morning, and they're playing Led Zeppelin on KLBJ. And then my friend Paul and I started having this conversation, how funny it would be if the song came off, like if the song finished and the DJ was Robert Plant,
yeah,
doing like the overnight shift.
And then he was
playing his own songs. And so I tweeted this. And I woke up this morning and looked through all these messages like, was it just a one-time thing? Or is it like, yeah, Robert Plant's doing the Saturday overnight shift on the classic rock station here? No, yeah. He's not.
Yeah.
But you can lie on the internet and people will believe you.
Oh, yeah. It's opinion and perspective are embraced over any kind of factual information these days.
Yeah.
It's people prefer it. It's,
yeah.
It goes down easier.
Hey, what are you listening to now? Just a question. Weird.
Well, you know, when you're putting your record out, you spend too much time listening to your stuff, getting it mixed and mastered and stuff.
Right.
I tend to put on stuff that's nothing like the music I play. So I listen to a lot of jazz records, and, you know, I like a lot of Wynton Marsalis stuff, but I also like Miles Davis stuff and Dexter Gordon and stuff like that. I like putting on records that kind of just take me to a different place.
Yeah.
I listen to classical music for the same reason. It's with pop and rock, my mind kind of tears the music apart.
Right, right, right. But then you listen to something that still, like when you're a kid, kind of mystifies you. Like, how does that guy do that? You can't break it apart. You just have to enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Bradford Marsalis has a live record called Bloomington I put on sometimes for that reason. It just blows my mind what those guys are playing and where they're going with it. And then, landscapes they kind of draw with the music and stuff. I just like, so I don't have to think about it. I can just let it be.
Yeah. Good. Good.
Yeah.
Well, Kurt, thank you so much for taking the time to come over, and I wish you all the luck with your album, American Made. It'll be out in June. Bodines.com. Kurt
Absolutely.
Newman will not be on Facebook, but you can find them there.
Yeah. I'll send secret messages to you all somehow.
Thank you, Kurt.
Absolutely.
All right. Yeah, man. Kurt Newman from Bodines, man. That was awesome. I was really, I had a great time talking to him, and I was really glad that he got to come over and I got to meet one of my heroes. This is a very exciting thing, having this podcast. So my dogs are over here, Taylor and Dylan. Taylor, you want to say hi? He's got nothing to say. Anyway, that was a song of theirs called All the World. That's the first single from the new record, American Made. And we're going to hear a song now called Everything You Wanted. All right. Kurt Newman, Bodines. Thank you for listening to How Did I Get Here? And, you know, keep on checking in. Bye.
Just two young kids wanna play some soul, make some noise, play some rock and roll. Stay out late, maybe skip some school. Or blue collar kids with nothing else to do. A little smoke and dream, riding on the brain. Yeah, we get through the night, just trying to feel alright. Well, I guess we must have found something deep inside. Found some place and maybe we could hide. We felt real good on that long summer night. Two young kids just trying to get it right. trouble, but we sure had fun. It's tramps like us, we was born to win. But the big time lights, oh, they burn so bright. I guess you closed your eyes, maybe broke sometimes. Now everything you wanted. Everything you had, well, you threw away. In them big time lights, they used to burn so bright. We can dream through the night, watch them fade from sight. 'Cause everything you want.